Tonight I'm going to speak about the world, as last night I spoke about the church, and then tomorrow night I want to speak about how the church and the world get related correctly together. Now, when Paul came to the city of Athens, before ever he began to speak to that city, he obviously walked through it with his eyes wide open, observing what went on, seeing the city. So that when he began to preach, he said, "As I walked through your city, I realized you were terribly religious. Altars everywhere, gods everywhere. And at the end of the main street, I came across an altar to an unknown god." Now, I don't know if you know how that altar came to be there. The Greeks really thought they had heaven covered with all the altars down the high street. But about 150 years before Jesus came, the city of Athens was completely destroyed in an earthquake. And the people who survived said, "One of the gods is angry." "Which one?" And they wondered how on earth to find out. So they let loose a flock of sheep. And they decided that where the sheep lay down, the nearest altar was the god who was angry. And he wanted the sacrifice of the sheep. Well, the sheep wandered down the high street in Athens, or what was left of it. One sat down at the altar of Jupiter and promptly paid for it with his life. Another lay down there and lost its head in a crisis too. But most of them went way down the high street and settled in the field at the bottom. And I can give you a very good biological reason why they did that. But the Greeks got really worried and they said, "There must be another god that we don't know about, or the sheep wouldn't have gone into the field." So they put up a block of stone in that field and they carved on it "to the unknown god." And that gave Paul his lead in. He said, "I've come to talk to you about the god you know is there, but the god you don't know." Now tonight I want to look at the world in which we live in the same kind of way. Asking, at what point can we begin to talk to people about Jesus Christ? How can we say to the world as it is that what we have to say is the most relevant thing that's being said? Looking at a city with eyes that really see. Now, I was in Paris for spring, just for a short visit, and walking down the Champs-Élysées with the trees coming out in bud, with soft, balmy air and those beautiful buildings that are now all cleaned up, it really was, I felt, the most lovely city in the world. And I'm sure if you've been to Paris in the spring, you had something of the same feeling. And then I began to look at that city and I saw a very different place. I noticed the selfishness of drivers on the road, which is even more marked there than here. I went and sat down for a cup of coffee at one of the roadside cafes in that great thoroughfare. And within 5 minutes, an attractive young girl came and offered to sell me her body. I walked further down the road and saw a cinema with a doubtful film being shown, and it was advertised as one of the best British films to be produced. And I felt just a pang of embarrassment that my nation had exported it. I went further down and noticed a queue of people outside a large shop. And inside the shop was a large IBM computer with all its various cabinets and an electric typewriter typing out sheets and sheets of paper. And these people were buying them at £2 a time in our money. And I said, "What's going on? What is this? What are they buying from this computer?" And the answer was, they are buying computerized horoscopes. And this thing has worked out, having been fed in with the day and the place of birth and all the rest, has fed out a forecast for the next month of these people's lives. And they're paying £2 a month to find out about their future. Then I walked on and I saw the Arc de Triomphe and I said, "What a wonderful archway." And somebody said, "Yes, two students just threw themselves off to commit suicide." It's always happening. And somehow that lovely, bright spring day, even though the clouds didn't come over the sky, had lost its brightness. I saw a city that's desperately needing God. Now, how do you see the world in which you live? A man said to me recently, you'll forgive the language, he said, the world's in a hell of a mess. And I said, if you're using that word with anything like the same meaning I would give it, you're not far wrong. And every newspaper we read and every television newscast we listen to depresses. At the beginning of this year, I watched Panorama give 1 hour's program summarizing the main events of 1970. And as they relived those events, it suddenly hit me between the eyes that of all the events, only one was a happy one. Every other one was sad or sordid. That was the world in which I had lived for 12 months. Now, what's going wrong with the world? It seems to be running away faster than anybody can stop it. I remember once in my boyhood seeing a terrible sight. I saw a pram running away down a hill into the thick of traffic with a baby in it. And it was careering down that hill. I've never forgotten the sight. And somehow when I look at my world, I see a world that's running away so fast that nobody seems able to stop it. With problems increasing at such a rate that people are wondering if we'll ever get on top of them. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I want to paint as fair and accurate a picture as I can. We are now asking, have we the talent, have we the technology, and above all, have we the time to put things right before it's too late? I want to highlight 3 major problems of our world and ask whether behind them there does not lie one single problem. One single problem whose answer lies in Jesus Christ alone. Let me first of all take what I would call the physical problem that my world faces. In this global village, no man is an island. I'm quoting someone else, and I'm sure you've heard the quote. This world is getting increasingly more and more crowded. There are more and more people in it. I told you last night there are 15 more Christians in the world every minute that I talk to you. But the other truth is that there are 150 more people in the world every minute. That means we are getting more and more crowded. And it's more and more difficult to live in a crowded world. There is the population problem. And I just give you some facts and figures. There are now 3,600 million of us living on this tiny planet, of whom a quarter are Chinese. We hardly have any contact with them at all, except a little bit of ping pong. This number, 3,600 million, will double in the next 30 years. And in the following 15 years, that number will double again. I can hardly begin to imagine it. We have not only a population problem in which food is becoming scarce, we have a pollution problem in which fresh air and water are becoming scarce. And by 1985, there will be a greater shortage of water than of food. And people will be dying of thirst rather than starvation. It's just as terrible to die that way. And coupled with this crowded world is the fact that we are being forced into larger and larger communities and units. The village is becoming the town is becoming the city is becoming the metropolis, and we are now being told that within less than 100 years' time, 98% of the world's population will be living in one city. Now, you know, the Bible, 2,000 years ago, talked of the end of history as one city, visible from every ocean. And I now pick up my Daily Telegraph magazine, and I discover that it's saying the same thing now, 2,000 years after God said it. The Bible calls it Babylon, and I have heard Christians debate where that city is going to be. I'll tell you where it's going to be, all over the world. computerized into one highly organized society. Now, not only are the small circles getting bigger and bigger until, literally, we shall all live in one world under one government in one circle, but as each circle of people needs a little pyramid of power to control it, as the circles get bigger, the pyramid climbs higher, and more power is given to fewer and fewer people who are further and further removed from the ordinary men. This is happening in industry. One of the great problems that's coming constantly to the men in my church is that their little firm has been taken over by a bigger one, and that by a bigger one, and that by a bigger one, until they feel, I can't ever get through to the boss anymore. Somewhere at the top, there's a little group of men controlling this vast organization, and I'm lost in it, and I'm being pushed around as if I'm just a number. And no longer am I a real human being. I can be made redundant tomorrow. This is the world in which the Christian has to live. And it's an insecure world with greater and greater control at the top and greater desire for freedom expressing itself in violent reaction to control at the bottom. This is our society. As we are more and more crowded, there is need for greater and greater control from the top. And as the greater control comes, there is a greater rebellion against it at the bottom. I illustrate it simply from the roads. Have you wondered why you can't drive now without seeing yellow lines in front of your eyes? Have you wondered why you can't turn anywhere in the city without seeing a traffic warden? Why at one junction I paused at in the West End of London, I noticed there were 16 different signs or lights which I had to notice as a motorist. And then you wonder why the driver becomes more and more rebellious against the limitation of his personal freedom. Here then is the problem of a crowded world. It needs more and more control from the top to run it, to make life possible. And yet that greater control means that we lose our freedom and we rebel against it just to be human. And if you want to understand the growth of violence and rebellion and fighting now coming into our United Kingdom itself, then you must understand this larger and larger circle and higher pyramid and greater control against which human beings react. It is the struggle between law and freedom, control and liberty. Now let's look at a second problem. The moral problem. And I'm not here going to join my voice to the protest movement at the permissive society. King Alfred, many centuries ago, not only burnt cakes, which alas became his most well-known exploit, but wrote some laws for England. And at the top of those laws he wrote 10 commandments, which he got from the Bible. That was the beginning of the influence of God's standards on our society. And right up until this last generation, the 10 Commandments have been a profound influence on the basic laws of our land. Doesn't mean that we've kept them all. It doesn't mean that they were all applied by law. You can't apply the law of coveting in a courtroom. How could you possibly try someone on that in a public courtroom? But the basic respect for God, for his name, for his day, the basic respect for family relationships, the basic respect for life, the basic respect for marriage, the basic respect for property, the basic respect for reputation, these have influenced our society to a degree of which perhaps we're unaware. And if people did break these standards, they knew that they were quite literally trespassing, which means simply to climb the fence into forbidden territory. The fence was there. And even if there were people over the other side of it, they knew that. We have lived now to see a day in which the fences have been pulled down, in which a person no longer realizes, I am being immoral living on this side of the fence. In which the phrase that is being used is this: our society is no longer moral and no longer immoral. It is amoral, which means the fence which said this is right, that is wrong, no longer exists. And to say to some people today that is wrong is to say something that has no meaning for them. They do not understand that language. In a society in which anything goes, we have moved from the affluent to the permissive, and that is a course that is followed by Israel in the Old Testament. If you read the prophet Amos, you'll discover that the one thing usually leads to the other. Now, it's customary to single sex as the most blatant example of this, and it's the easiest thing in the world to do that. And there's no doubt that standards of modesty have slipped radically over the last 10, 15 years. But there are many other areas in which things have also slipped. The standard of honesty is another glaring example of this. Petty pilfering in Britain has now reached mammoth proportions and indeed accounts for millions of pounds lost every year. I preached a sermon on Thou Shalt Not Steal, and a Christian man came up to me afterwards and he said, I've been taking notes of your sermon in this notebook. And I said, fine. Well, he said, there's something wrong. This notebook I'd pinched from the office. What do I do? Do I take it back with notes on Thou Shalt Not Steal in it? What do I do? It is no longer don't take it because it's someone else's, but take it if they can afford it. In other words, don't steal from the village grocer, but the supermarket, they can afford it, so it's all right to lift something there. One could go on giving many illustrations, but I want you as Christians not just to look at the superficial permissiveness, but to go very much deeper and to ask why it is happening. To protest because someone has spots without asking why, what is the disease of which that is the symptom, seems to me a futile thing to do. These are spots in our society. They are symptoms of something much deeper. Who is to blame? Who is responsible for the permissiveness of our society? Now, the easiest person to blame is the businessman who is exploiting commercially this permissiveness, whether he's a film producer or a book publisher or what have you. Very easy to blame him. And there's no doubt about it that there's money in this. The film industry is on its beam ends financially. And the kind of film that will be shown, those two notorious films that even the Daily Mirror called filthy, which are going to be shown in Birmingham next week, are the cinema's desperate attempt to save itself financially. Are we going to blame them? Are we going to say, you are doing it all? We will protest about you. Let me say that there could be no commercial exploitation unless there was public demand. No one can make money on things that people don't want. So we've got to go behind the commercial exploitation to something deeper, to the public demand there is. And we've got to ask, why is there this public demand? And we've got to ask why it is that people are seeking any kind of sensation they can to get something of a thrill out of life. And finding they're having to go for more and more perverted thrills to keep up the same kind of sensation. Well, there are many reasons, I believe, not just one. One reason is that we live between the Second and the Third World War. And that's a very insecure place to live. We are reacting against the Second War and the limitations of personal pleasure that that brought. And we are reacting against the threatening insecurity of the Third World War that will take away not only those pleasures, but possibly even life itself. And people in that kind of security our insecurity, are bound to say, let us eat, drink, and be merry. We're all going to be blown to bits by an atom bomb tomorrow. In a recent Gallup survey poll of the sixth formers of the grammar schools in Surrey, 60% of the young people did not believe they would survive to the age of 40. They believed that somebody would press the button before then. Can you understand why they want to get on and enjoy life now? There are other reasons. We've now had a generation of an educational theory that says the only way to get knowledge is to try something, to have a project, an experience in it. It's the modern form of something that was said at the beginning of history, eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. There's no other way to find out but find out for yourself. Don't accept anyone else's word for what will do you harm or good. Try it yourself. Do a project. Don't even believe what teacher says. Now you know that children run through a kind of stage. Up to the age of 5, daddy and mummy are infallible. From 5 to 10, teacher's infallible. From 10 onwards, Jimmy is infallible. But nowadays even the teacher says, don't take it from me, find out for yourself. We are now experiencing the fruits of that educational philosophy. For it is being applied right through life. Don't you tell me what's wrong. I will find out for myself. I will eat that fruit. We are reaping also a harvest of an urbanized industrial society in which people are being forced into large, lonely cities, and in which life is becoming more and more boring and monotonous in the factory. And there must be some way to find a little excitement. If the older person turns to bingo, the younger person turns to sex. But it must be something exciting. But you know, even behind all this, we must go even deeper, and we must say, it is due, behind all the influence of society, to the fall of man himself. Man is behaving this way because he is this way. It is not a strange or unnatural thing. It is the natural thing for fallen man to be doing as he is doing today. But we've got to go behind that too. And we've got to say, who is responsible for that? And we must then say that this world is Satan's world. I remember preaching on the text from 1 John. We know that we are of God, and the whole world lieth in the power of the evil one. You know that text. It was unfortunate that a young lady was singing at that service and chose as her solo, "He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands." Now, one of us was wrong. Until we recognize that this world is Satan's kingdom, that he is in a position to offer this world to anybody who wants it. Do you remember the dreadful day when Jesus was offered the post of Antichrist? Satan said, "I will give you all the kingdoms of the world." That's the post of Antichrist. And Christ turned it down, but he did not say, "It's not yours to give." Satan can and will give the world to whoever will bow down to him. He will give the power of this world. He will give the pleasure of this world. He'll give the popularity of this world to anybody on his own terms. And he is responsible. But we must go even beyond that. Who is letting Satan do all this? And my answer is this: God is responsible for our permissive society. That is why we must think very deeply and carefully before we make a superficial protest. And I say that on the basis of Romans 1. The evidence that we have in our society is exactly the same kind of thing that is there outlined. It reads like a police desk blotter. And here we have a society in which God has taken the brakes off. When men give God up, God gives men up. And his wrath is shown in saying, All right, you want to live without me, then live without me. You think you can manage society without me, then manage it without me. See what happens. And therefore, when we face the permissive society of today, we're facing the wrath of God being worked out. Do you want to fight that? I'm inclined to want it to go on until men see that you can't run life without God. I want them to see the logical end product of that. I want them to find that the far country is a very hungry place, and we are beginning to see it. There is just the beginnings of hope today that we're going to see a religious revival in the 70s. Men and women who've gone right down this other road of permissiveness are getting to the point where they know it's a dead end. And they're looking around for an answer. And maybe God's wrath on society is a disguised form of his mercy in showing men their need. If showing men their need this way will bring this nation back to God, then don't you welcome that? Or would you rather have a censored society that can control this without God? Which do we want? And therefore I believe that God in his mercy is saying to our nation, you have chosen to live without me, then this is the world that your children will have to grow up in. And in his mercy, he may well cause us as a nation to seek his face again in the next few years. What I'm saying again is this. Just as the physical problem is the problem between controlling our crowded world and giving people freedom, in the moral problem, the same problem occurs again. Are we faced with the choice of prohibition and permissiveness? Must it be a censorious control of our society from the top, or a permissive society from the bottom that says we'll do what we like? Is that the choice? There are those humanists who are saying that is the choice, and who want a much greater censorship and control morally of this land. In a democracy, we won't get it. Because in a democracy, people ultimately get what they want. But is this the choice? A society based on prohibition and control, or a society based on complete freedom? Now the third area, and I'm afraid I'm going to go much deeper here, and after I finish this third one, I'm going to come back to the Christian answer. And if you find this next one a bit difficult, then you just have a little rest and come back in 10 minutes. I want now to talk about the mental problem. I've spoken of the physical problem of a crowded world and the tension between control and liberty. I've spoken of the moral problem of our world and the tension between control and liberty, prohibition and permissiveness. Let me now approach the same problem through the thinking of people. In the last 10 years, there has been a revolution in the thought of our society. And I agree with the man who said there is a greater gap between parents and their own children today than between those parents and the ancient Greeks. There is such a radical revolution in thinking that I find even in Christian circles, there are parents who completely fail to understand their own youngsters. And they come to me and say, I just don't understand what's happened to them. I can't make head or tail of how they talk and how they behave. There's been a revolution in thinking. It has been from one kind of thinking to a very different kind of thinking. I'm going to have to simplify it. I'm going to give two labels to the kinds of thought or philosophy, if you want a big word. It is a change from the empirical way of thinking to the existential way of thinking. And if those words mean nothing to you, let me try and explain them. The empirical way of thinking is this. If you want to find out what's true and what's real, you must approach it with your mind. You must approach it scientifically. You must have proof for what you believe. You must examine the world around you until you find the laws that control the universe, the laws that control human behavior. So you study biology and zoology, and then you study sociology and psychology. And once you've discovered the laws, then you can transform society scientifically, with the mind, with reason. And that's truth. And if you debate with any humanist, you'll find that this is his outlook. It is an empirical outlook in approaching truth. But it results in a society that is manipulated, that is a technocracy, in which you are simply a data card in a computer. The book of Revelation in the Bible predicts a day when every human being will have a branded number on their body. Do you know that it is already being suggested that when a baby is born, they be branded with a number on the sole of their foot, which will be their computer number for the rest of their life, and all the records of their health, of their income tax, of their employment, will be under that number, and they'll be buried with that number. Once again, it is revelation coming true. You can see it unfolding. This is the empirical society that has become so unscientific, so rational, so controlled, that men and women saying, I'm not a machine, the computer may outthink me, but I've got a heart I can feel. And the reaction has been to an existential way of approaching truth, which says, truth and reality are not discovered by the mind, but by the heart. Not through the senses and experiment, but through the sensations of my inward experience. And meaningful reality in life is discovered in emotion, in sensation, in experience. And I will get that experience through drugs. I will get it through sex. I will get it through loud music. I will get a kick through dressing immodestly. I will get this meaningful experience any way I can. But that's reality, and that's truth for me. It's of the heart, not the mind. And this is the great swing. It is responsible for the great swing from science to art. And indeed, there were letters to the Times recently complaining that young people are no longer going into science in the universities. They want to do the humanities, the arts. It explains the drug scene. It explains your own youngster who's dressing in that psychedelic way and who loves noise, and you can hear that record player going in their bedroom all the time. And against those two, we are saying one gives control, the other gives a freedom that leads to license. And once again, it's the old, old problem. Am I going to be scientifically controlled by those who use their minds, or am I going to be emotionally free to express myself in some form of art? When I was at school, if a boy of 17 had started writing poetry, I know what we'd have thought about him. Yet the extraordinary thing today is that young people love writing poetry. They would rather do that than study something rational or scientific. Now, once again, we've approached it from a very different angle, but we've come to the same problem: control and freedom. And here I come right back from a look at my world to the answer of Jesus Christ to the physical problem, to the moral problem, to the mental problem. I have tried to show you that in all these realms, our world is being forced to face a choice of dictatorship or democracy, of laws controlling us and making life possible, or liberty that reduces life to anarchy and chaos and destroys itself. Law and license, control and freedom. Is man made for a dictatorship? Is man made for a democracy? Which is going to win? According to my Bible, we are heading for a world dictatorship. Of the two things, democracy is so self-destructive when man tries to control himself that we will be bound to accept dictatorship as the only possibility of peace and security. And the Bible would say that the chaos of every man doing his own thing will lead human society to say to a dictator, rule over us and give us some peace and security. Right-wing politics, extreme right-wing, is what the Bible forecasts for the future. A world dictator, Antichrist himself, controlling the whole pyramid by consent of the people. My answer is that human beings were not made for democracy, and they were not made for dictatorship. They were made for a kingdom. They were made to be subjects of a king. This is the only way that society will run. I was not made to run myself, nor was I made to be under someone else's totalitarian control. I was made to be the subject of a king. Now it is very interesting that our world is moving right away from the notion of royalty. 24 crowned heads of Europe have fallen in the last 50 years. And our own queen has been made a constitutional monarch with very little power at all. So we are not really a united kingdom. And from the kingdom conception and royal government, the world has moved to dictatorship in some countries and to democracy in another. To totalitarian control on the one hand, under which a third of the human race are living, and to a democracy which is already cracking up as people do their own thing in the other half of the world. And Jesus came saying, repent, for the kingdom is here. The kingdom is breaking in. The one form of human society that can work. Now let's look a little more closely at this. You see, the world is needing one person who is capable of controlling society and at the same time giving people perfect liberty within that control. And we're always looking for the next prime minister and the next president who'll do this for us. We will never find him. I pity Mr. Heath, as I pitied Mr. Wilson, as I pity the poor people who've swung from Conservative to Labour yesterday's elections and today's, as I pity those who swung from Labour to Conservative in the previous elections. I pity them because they are still seeking for a person or a party who can balance out control and liberty in society. And there's no one can do it except Jesus. And my Bible tells me that one day this king is going to step back into the world, and when he does, the kingdom will come, and there will be for the first time perfect control and perfect liberty, and righteousness and peace will kiss each other, and law and liberty will be rightly balanced. I have no hope for our society as a society until he comes back. Which is why every time I pray, I say, thy kingdom come. Until the king comes, the kingdom cannot come. And until the kingdom comes, we're going to be torn between control and license. And I see this as a terrible alternative, the only choice our world has without Christ. The prohibitive society or the permissive society. There's nothing in between. Praise God that the kingdom is going to come one day. And I long for that kingdom more than anything else, don't you? But now I come to the good news. Does that mean that all we've got to say to people in our present world is, wait for the kingdom? Someday Jesus will come back and it'll all be put right. Someday you'll have a perfect balance. Is that all I can say? If that's all I can say, then what bad news that is. Because a person could reply, I may be dead and gone before then. I'm going to go on living as I am. But here's where the message and the gospel of Jesus comes in. Not only the gospel for the unbeliever, but the gospel for the believer at a convention. I can enter the kingdom now. I can come into that control now. And as I do so, I come into perfect freedom. For there is a third possibility. I do not need to choose between doing my own thing, wanting to do whatever I like, and being under absolute control of someone else. The third possibility is that I find the liberty of the Spirit of God, in which alone my life will be controlled as it ought to be, and I will feel and know perfect freedom. That's why I was thrilled that whoever chose that hymn, maybe it was our chairman, was it? Whoever chose that hymn had no idea what I was going to say tonight. And yet look at it. Make me a captive, Lord, and then I shall be free. Force me to render up my sword, and I shall conquer be. I have talked to those who advocate totalitarian control of our society. Ban this, prohibit that, stop the other. And I find they are not free. And I tremble to think what society would be like if they got their way. And I've talked to those who say, away with power, away with controls, away with laws. I acknowledge no authority but my own desire. And I find that they're not free either. They have become the victims, the conformists to a new society. They have become the slaves to their own passions. And they're not free. They've got to go along a road that leads to despair and self-destruction. A boy of 21 on the television said recently, at the age of 21, even sex has gone dead on me. And I have talked to young men and women who will be dead by the age of 30 because of the way that they've chosen to live, and one's heart bleeds for them. And I have also seen people from both ends, the right and the left wing morally, come to Jesus Christ and surrender complete control to him, and find that in the liberty of the Spirit they have all that they need of control and liberty. They are free. Freedom is not the opportunity to do what I like. It is the opportunity to do what he likes. Nobody is free to be a good person until they find the Holy Spirit. And that's liberty. There are those who say, I want to be free to be bad. Well, that's one kind of freedom, but it's sheer slavery. Real freedom is to say, I want to be free to be good. I want to be free to be the sort of person I long to be in my best moments. I want to be free to be the sort of person I know I could be and ought to be. That's real freedom. You see, Galatians has been called the Charter of Christian Liberty. If you wanted a follow-up to tonight's address, go home and read Paul's letter to the Galatians. The Galatians were in danger of falling into one extreme or the other. One extreme is to get into legalism and law. And Christians, I appeal to you, keep legalism out of your Christianity. Keep out of your fellowships that legalism that starts making laws about Sunday observance, that starts saying to the new generation, you must do this and you mustn't do that, that introduces a literalism which is killing and dead. There is a legalism that wants to control Christians too much at the human level. And I'm sure you understand what I'm talking about. Some of you have escaped from Christian fellowships that became totalitarian in control and legalistic and fell into that trap. And Paul says to the Galatians, if you get circumcised, you go back under the law. You go back into legalism. You go back into this external control. That's what he says in chapters 3 and 4. But in chapters 5 and 6 he says, but watch it, don't go to the other extreme. Don't think that because you're free from the law, you're free to sin. Don't think that you're now free to hate. Don't think that you're now free for immorality or gossip. Don't think that. That's license. That's slavery. Don't jump from the slavery of the law into the slavery of license, or from the slavery of license back into the slavery of law. Jump into the liberty of the Spirit. And he says, then you will be set free from the works of the flesh. You'll find you can't do them then. There again is a mistranslation in many Bibles at this point. Paul says, walk in the Spirit and you will not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Not walk in the Spirit and don't fulfill the lusts, but walk in the Spirit and you can't. You're set free from them. And walk in the Spirit and a fruit grows in your life that's lovely. One fruit with nine flavors. Not nine fruits, but one fruit, singular, with nine flavors. And the flavors are love, joy, and peace toward God. Patience, kindness, and goodness towards your fellow. And patience, meekness, faithfulness, meekness, and self-control in yourself. That's a lovely liberty. Do you want to be free to love? Do you want to be free for joy, for peace, for patience, kindness, goodness? The freedom comes as you enter the kingdom, repent of the life that was self-controlled and therefore had to be controlled from outside, and come into the glorious liberty of the sons of God. Do you see that the one thing that's needed in our society is the preaching of the kingdom and the preaching of the king? And when Jesus came into a society that was already going rotten, and if you read the story of the Roman Empire, you'll find that already by Jesus' day the thing was rotten. The wrath of God was already on that empire. Out of the first 15 emperors, 14 were homosexual, and their example went right down through the empire. And Jesus didn't come to lead a protest movement. He came saying, repent, the kingdom of God is at hand. And he came with a message of compassion and love to bring people freedom and the truth that would set them free. A friend of mine was accosted by a prostitute in the streets of a city. And he didn't take the opportunity to condemn her. He said, how did you come to be like this, dear? God has something much better for you. That's the essential Christian note in a society that's got so far away from God. Let us therefore be sure that we are free from sin before we cast a stone. Let us make sure that our lives are all in the kingdom and that Christ is king over every department of my life, over my money, over my family relationships, over my sex, over my work, over my conversation, over my leisure activities, over my church, so that I can say the Lord is king. So that my little life becomes a demonstration of a kingdom that is under control, and yet a control that allows me to be perfectly free to be what God meant me to be. Well, now that's our world, and I've tried to look at it through the eyes of Christ tonight. Tomorrow night, God willing, I want to bring the two together. The church, which is God's instrument for extending the kingdom in the world, a kingdom which is righteousness and joy and peace, and a world which is showing all the evidence of having given God up and having been given up by God. How do we bring them together in such a way that the church gets right into the world, but the world doesn't get inside the church? Come tomorrow night and we'll talk further about that.